Today, what's it like when your father tells you that he supports a far-right leader whose policies you find terrifying? And we hear from a woman whose frozen eggs are set to be destroyed in around 2 years because of a legal time limit. John Domikos was born and raised in the south of England, but he grew up speaking English and Hungarian, the language of his father, Janos.
I was very proud of having both cultures, although, you know, I had all the sort of, you know, people laughing at my funny surname, and I was kind of embarrassed about my dad's accent at the school gate sometimes. But I think really I was happy and proud to have this other side.
When John was 30, his parents split up and his dad moved back to Hungary. It was around then that he began working as a filmmaker for The Guardian.
If there is such a thing as a Western liberal media elite, in many ways, that pains me to admit it, I'm kind of it. You know, I drink craft beer, I'm kind of vegetarian, I have a beard, and I'm probably about as liberal as it comes in many ways.
Meanwhile, his dad's politics went in a completely different direction.
My dad is a Viktor Orban supporter. Now, that makes us about as far apart as it's possible to get in political terms. The Guardian has roundly condemned Viktor Orban. He's the embodiment of everything that's wrong with politics in Europe these days. And my dad thinks he's great. So while many families would choose to avoid politics in his situation, we decided on a somewhat riskier strategy, which is to take a road trip through Hungary, 7 days in a car together, and have it all out and put it on film.
From The Guardian, I'm Anoush Garistana. Today in Focus, a father and son's cross-country road trip to understand why Viktor Orban has a hold on Hungary. The story begins in the 1970s.
My dad basically left Hungary for love. My mum was travelling in Eastern Europe and dropped by Hungary and met this man that she fell in love with. They corresponded by letters for a while, and my mum came back to Hungary to marry him so that he was able to leave what was then the Iron Curtain and come to live in Britain. So mainly it was love.
And what year was it? How old was he?
It was 1978 when he arrived here, the year before I was born. He would probably have been about 30.
What did he leave behind?
I think he left a fairly liberal version of what we all know as that kind of crushing, sort of overbearing sort of system, you know, where you didn't quite feel free. In terms of his family, it was quite a small, close-knit family. His parents were teachers. They were kind of international in their outlook, their family. Although my dad didn't speak a word of English, it's important to say, when he came to England.
How did they fall in love? Did your mum speak Hungarian?
They figured out the language a bit later. The love came first.
No. Can they literally not speak to each other at all?
I found some letters where they corresponded, and my dad was obviously writing this with the help of a sort of dictionary, and his mother, who was a language teacher, helped him. But it's very kind of stilted English. There's a photo of the wedding in Hungary, you know, where my mum's there and the very small Hungarian family gathered around. I mean, everyone on mum's side thought she was a bit crazy as well, going for this Hungarian guy.
But she was in love. Your dad grew up under communism, as you mentioned, and he actually remembers Orban's initial rise to power. What did that moment mean to him?
My dad was watching from England as the Berlin Wall fell. The Berlin Wall fell because Hungary opened its borders with Austria. And so Hungary was kind of the focal point over the eventual collapse of communism in Europe. Orban played a role in that. I mean, it's disputed how important he was, but he was certainly a sort of prominent student activist speaker at the time. I don't think Orban's role had a particularly striking effect on my dad, but just the fact of it happening, my dad said to me that they grew up believing that this was never going to end. And it's hard to imagine that now. He told me that he thought only a nuclear war would bring about the end of communism in Eastern Europe and Central Europe. He said they could hardly believe their eyes that this was happening. It really was a moment of great hope for him personally and for the country.
And do you know whether he planned to go back?
My dad was never a fervent sort of patriot or nationalist. He obviously cared a lot about Hungary, and he felt very strongly that we should speak Hungarian. So he spoke to us only in Hungarian, but he never talked about the country in terms of going back. I mean, he only went back after my parents separated. It wasn't like something that was inevitable from day one. He went back to Hungary in 2009. Hungary at that stage was in a mess, had a very large foreign debt. People were very poor, inequality had grown. The political party, which was the left at that time, was mired in a corruption scandal. And this was what my dad moved back to. And I think he became political then when he saw the state the country was in. And that was also the exact time that Viktor Orban came to power.
Many Hungarians have their hopes pinned on Viktor Orban. After 8 years in opposition, he's back center stage. And for the second time, will be leading the country as prime minister.
So the current government under Viktor Orban was elected in 2010. And if you were a voter in 2010 in Hungary, in some level, the only reasonable choice was Fidesz, Orban's party.
Kim Lane Chappell is professor of sociology and foreign affairs at Princeton. She's been studying Hungary for the past 3 decades.
The socialists had been discredited by their economic mismanagement, and the liberals, who had been in politics and in power since 1990, had basically disintegrated. There was a tiny, vaguely left, vaguely green, but mostly vague party called LMP, full of people who had never done anything in politics before. And the only other alternative was Jobbik, which was this far-right neo-Nazi party. So if you're looking at that political spectrum, the sane vote was Orban. His campaign speeches were against corruption and against austerity. Nothing extraordinary, nothing radical, and nothing like what he did after he took office. So 53% of the Hungarian electorate voted for his party because of the ways the Hungarian election system works. That 53% turned into two-thirds of the parliamentary seats. And that's in a system where a single two-thirds vote could change the constitution. After that, Orban has been cemented into power. He completely rewrote the entire constitutional framework, changed all of the checks and balances in the system, and within 3 years, he had fully captured the constitutional court, which since that time has done nothing that he didn't approve.
So one of the issues that people think a lot about is border security. Let's talk about Orban's approach to the issue of migration.
The migration issue has been his ticket to success. Orban started campaigning against migrants about a year before any of them showed up. When they came, it was like a gift to Orban. And the first thing he did, of course, was to construct this fence on the border with Serbia. And the main effect of that fence was to divert migrants so that Hungary wouldn't be their first port of entry in the EU. Because if a migrant sets foot on your territory, you're the one who has to process their asylum claims. So Orban was evading the legal constraints. But then he realized that there was an anti-migration sentiment in right-wing parties all over the EU. And he's made a bid to make himself the head of those anti-migration forces in the EU, and hence to become a much bigger player on the European scene. So right now in Hungary, what you see is that he set his whole political party and all of his energies toward winning the European election, not just in Hungary, but really all over Europe. One imagines after the European elections, he might actually have a block of sympathetic MEPs in the European Parliament.
Just finally, then, what do you think comes next for Hungary?
So one of the real challenges Hungary faces is that its economy is really imperiled. And it's imperiled in part by Orban's anti-migration stance. His policies have driven hundreds of thousands of Hungarians out of the country. There was one recent estimate that said that 1 million Hungarians have left since 2007. Hungary is now suffering from severe labor shortages. That's one of the reasons why Orban passed this law that allows employers to require their employees to work up to 400 hours of overtime every year. What they really need is immigration. And that's how most countries would solve a labor shortage problem. But because Orban's backed himself into this corner of being the anti-migration leader, he can't actually, you know, build up his labor force that way. So his only remedy was to actually force the workers who were there to work longer hours. And that's generated an unprecedented scale and scope of protests against his government.
For John Domokos, this trip to Hungary was all about trying to understand what attracted his father to Orban's politics.
We were always very close personally. You know, I love him dearly, and him me. And he was always proud of what I do. But he has a very strongly held a view, quite a binary worldview, that comes from communist era divisions, that there are two types of people. You either support national interests or you support globalist international interests. In communist era times, this would be, you know, you would be either part of the resistance against occupiers, or you'd be part of the collaborators. In today's terms, that's kind of global liberals who are pro-Europe, pro-migration, or there are the nationalists who basically believe in protecting the state's assets, protecting its borders, and protecting its sovereignty. I often felt myself put in a box of this globalist liberal who has no sort of interest in country or place. And that's part of what I wanted to set about to sort of challenge, or at least, you know, get beyond these binary worldviews.
So off you go to Hungary for a road trip with your dad. Have you guys spent this much time one-on-one before?
Never.
Never.
We were both nervous because, you know, especially recently, we're always there with kids and family, and we might go off, like I say, to the pub and have a drink and talk politics, and it often ends badly, but that's like one evening. We've never spent sort of, this was 5, 6, 7 day trip we had planned.
So tell me about the itinerary you planned.
So I wanted to go across the political spectrum and also across the kind of geographical spectrum. So we began in Budapest. I took him to a sort of standard lefty demo against a new homelessness law that Orbán had brought in. It was all going fine. He was like, yeah, these people are very caring. You know, they were holding up placards. They were talking about defending homeless people's rights. And my dad was quite impressed with how sort of orderly and stuff. And then when we spoke to one of them afterwards, he said that no one pays attention to all this stuff because they're all paranoid about migration.
Terrible state. Very hard for anyone to talk about anything else now than this paranoid fear from migration.
And this idea of paranoia and being written off as paranoid. My dad was sort of behind me biting his tongue, and this set him off on a rant to me afterwards.
Ez nem paranoiás, ez egy valós veszély.
About how fears about migration were not paranoia, and that this young guy didn't have a clue, with a few expletives thrown in, because, you know, we're entering an era, you know, the next 10, 20, 30, 50 years of likely mass migration and huge global changes, and that it was perfectly rational to worry about a small country like Hungary in the middle of all this. This struck me as a very good point, and I'd never seen it like that before.
From there, you drove south to the city of Vesto, and you met the pro-Orbán mayor. Orbán's economic policies are really important to your dad. Did you get the impression those policies were working there?
I was struck by a very genuine desire from the mayor and from everyone I met there that they wanted to make this place a viable place to live. They had this work program money, which I went there imagining people digging up the roadside or something like that. And they were making artisan cheeses and pickles. It was culture in its deepest sense. I was very sort of struck by those intentions.
It was interesting because your dad basically introduced you as being from The Guardian and was like, oh, it's a sort of liberal lefty thing. And he was obviously saying that in quite a dismissive way. How did you feel at that moment?
Hogy én Guardian nevű újságnél dolgozok.
Balliberális újság.
Mindig szíves.
I think, to be fair to my dad, it was kind of, it was his banter. It was gentle mocking, which we were both doing to each other, sort of this trip. But what I would say is it played into this sense that I have, I carried with me going into the trip, which is that I'm put in a box. And it played a role, I think, of building up a kind of tension in me, which did then explode later on the trip.
So the fight you're talking about began when you were trying to find the farm your dad had lived on as a child. And it was an emotional moment for him. And you were really focused on getting the right shot. And then these farm dogs started to bark and you left, but your dad was upset and you never got the close-up of the farmhouse. And then you got angry too.
I just let him have it. I was like, you're always criticising me. Every step of the way, you know, you've been doing little digs at me.
Cognitive distortion. Keywords
He's like, always, never, these words you use to trap me. He uses this phrase, cognitive distortion keywords, which I believe is a phrase he took from therapy when he was separating from my mum.
What does it mean?
It means words that distort the underlying reality. And I kind of took the phrase on as a little motto running through the film, and I use it to think about the way Orban speaks and the way we all speak politically.
Did you start to understand why your dad had the views that he did have on immigration?
Yeah, totally. I mean, if you're from Britain, like, you can close your eyes and picture the map of your country. You don't have to try hard to see how it looks. It's been like that because there's a sea around it. Hungary is a country whose borders have been redrawn and fought over and walked all over by foreign boots. We're talking soldiers here, you know, and this is at the farm. It's down near the Romania border and quite near the Serbian border. So, you know, this is contested territory. As my dad said, whenever there's an occupation or a war, this area always gets it. And so I can understand now why to see lots of migrants arriving, large amounts of people walking there. But I can understand how you would feel worried and protective.
And he described being scared.
And scared, yeah.
Just to be clear, what does he want on migration? Does he want closed borders?
No, I mean, we had a lengthy conversation about borders and migration. And my dad said that he believed in refugees and refugees' rights. And he believed that Hungary should accept genuine refugees and that they should be treated fairly. Now, whether or not they are is a completely different question. He told me, you know, if you come from a country of 60 million people that has had a global empire like Britain had and whose language has gone around the world, you cannot understand what it feels like to come from a country with less than 10 million people, a shrinking population, a language that no one else speaks. He said at one point, you know, he worried that Hungary's culture would disappear altogether. And so what he thinks is that you need to have strongly protected borders, not closed borders, just a strong protection of your home country to better enable you to help those people within your country. For my father, Orban is a source of hope. And I hadn't really thought of Orban like this before.
What do you think of Viktor Orban?
I don't feel any differently about him as a person now than I did before all of this. I worry about the direction he's taking Hungary in, both in concrete sort of political terms, you know, the changes he's made to the courts and his control of the media. He's building a very powerful sort of unassailable position, and that really, really worries me. His rhetoric about religious and ethnic purity of Hungary, I find very both personally offensive, morally wrong, and also not good for the long-term interests of Hungary. I worry about that. And it's just the divisiveness. We saw Orban speak at a commemoration for the Hungarian Revolution of 56. Mi magyarok szenvedtünk eleget a birodalmaktól. That should be an occasion for national coming together. He used it to ram home these divisive ideas about elites and Christian democratic purity of Hungary. I find that as dangerous as ever.
You understand why your dad is persuaded by those arguments and so many other people are, but doesn't it terrify you that this leader is offering hope to people like your dad, and that your dad's perhaps missing all the bad stuff that goes alongside it?
I don't think my dad does miss all of the bad stuff. He told me that he is worried about corruption. He's worried about the long-term problem of Orban becoming too powerful. He also does want refugees to be looked after and welcomed. My dad isn't unconditional in his support for Orban. He's aware of the problems, but there isn't anyone else that he feels he can vote for.
So you and your dad didn't change each other's minds on the subject of Viktor Orban. But by the end of the road trip, you did seem to reach a kind of emotional understanding.
If there was anything like what I would call an epiphany, it came kind of at the sausage festival, where I was thinking about all the things that my dad had passed on to me.
There you are, on stage at the sausage festival, yeah, Talking about how much you love sausages with your dad. How did you end up in that situation?
And this is the biggest, I believe, sausage festival anywhere in the world. The organisers welcome us as guests of honour. You know, you've come from England, could you please go up on stage? And there's sort of thousands of people there in the audience. And what do you want me to say? Or just, you know, say something about how much you love sausages. And so there I am on stage saying, you know, Yeah, I grew up, you know, learning the appreciation of sausages from my father, and here I am, and it's a highlight of my trip to be here, you know.
Was it the best part of your trip?
I said that on stage to please the organisers, but looking back, it probably was. I don't want to overdo the sausage metaphor, but people there were talking about how the recipe is passed down from father to son and grandfather to father and family to family, you know, and I guess I was just thinking about all the things that my father passed on to me, and I turned out the way I am because of him, and he's turned out the way he is because of his family and his life experiences. And that was kind of the sort of realisation we reached to that point, and I felt like that's a reasonable kind of conclusion to come to at the end of it all. And if we can carry that understanding forward, then we've gained something here.
John's road trip with his dad is part of The Guardian's Populism series. Do watch John's film, Orban, My Dad and Me, at theguardian.com. Coming up, fertility experts are urging the government to overturn rules that require women who freeze their eggs to use them within 10 years. They say technological advancements mean eggs can now be stored indefinitely.
In today's non-stop world, making quality time for yourself is more important than ever. When you buy a subscription to The Guardian and The Observer, you can look forward to sitting back and leafing through every page at your own pace. From the latest groundbreaking investigations to recipes, reviews, award-winning sports coverage, and more. Plus, we're now offering an additional 50% off our 3-month subscriptions, only when you subscribe before the 17th of February. Just search Guardian Subscriptions.
Welcome back. We're about to hear from a woman who doesn't want to be named, who froze her eggs almost 8 years ago. She's still not in a position to use them, and now the 10-year fertility deadline could end her hopes of having a child.
I'm fairly sure that if this was all about sperm, the people in charge would have changed it just like that. It's terribly unfair. I mean, I've always known I wanted to have kids. When I was a school kid, I thought to myself, oh yeah, I'll get married about age 25 and I'll have 2 kids and I'll be married and it'll all be lovely. And then I got involved in a very busy career. I didn't really have long-term relationships in my 20s at all. I didn't. Because you're young and you just think that you've got your whole life ahead of you. It was only when I got to my mid-30s and I was just out of a relationship and felt very single, but also knew that I really wanted to have kids, I was starting to panic a little bit. And I was quite lucky in that one of my closest friends is actually a fertility doctor. She does IVF treatment. And I remember very clearly around about my 35th birthday, she said to me, you know, if you want to have kids and you are serious about the egg freezing issue, then you have to get on and do it now. I just thought, right, I'm going to do it. And luckily my parents had offered to pay for it because it's not cheap. I'm now 44 and I've got 2.5 years left storage time. And all of a sudden it feels very close. You know, it's a real dilemma. I don't know what I'm going to do. I mean, I am in a relationship, but it's still quite early days. And, you know, forcing someone into having children with you when it's early on in a relationship is not something that you want to do. I've heard lots of clinicians talk about how the 10 years is a silly deadline and there's no medical reason why you can't freeze the eggs for longer than that. And it feels like nobody has considered advances in science. It just feels like politicians particularly don't get the concept. They don't understand what egg freezing is. They don't understand that lots of women are doing it. And nobody's really put their heads together and thought, yeah, this is a silly law. We need to quickly change it. Lots of women like me don't have lots of time to waste. I gather that it could be changed with a very simple amendment. And I can understand why it might not be high up on their agenda. There are lots of bigger NHS issues to worry about. But it's a small corner of the law that's for the people involved very, very important and very, very unjust. I think loads more women are going to be doing this in the coming years. Big corporates are now offering it as a corporate perk to joiners in their 20s. And you think, they haven't thought about this either. If you're going to freeze your eggs at age 25 as a corporate perk, great, but then you've only got 10 years on the clock. They would be destroyed at age 35, probably at the age that you may be using them or way before the age that you're using them. So the whole thing seems really pointless. My eggs, the clinic is now moved to actually not far away from where I live, and I pass it sometimes on the bus and I do think, oh my goodness, my eggs are in there, so I do think about it sometimes, and sometimes I panic that there's a power cut, they would have had a power cut and suddenly they're gone or something. My close friends are very sympathetic and they know the situation. But then some of them have also said, well, why don't you try, get an anonymous donor and just do it on your own? But often the ones telling me that that's a possibility are the ones that are happily married with their own children. And I don't think they quite get the concept of having a completely anonymous donor and how on earth you cope as a single mother. I do talk about it with my partner a little bit, but I try not to mention it very much because, it's just really unattractive, I think, for a guy to know that his new girlfriend is desperate for a child. And I think he's sympathetic, but on the other hand, it's maybe not quite the right time. But I'm hoping that'll change.
You can read Hannah Devlin's reporting on egg freezing at theguardian.com. That's it for today. My thanks to John Domikos, his dad Janosch, and the woman who shared her fertility story. Today's episode was produced by Mithali Rao, India Rakesson, and Elizabeth Cassin. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executives are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. See you tomorrow.